Hello, Spacers. From Austin, Texas, I'm Christopher Schmidt, and on today's show, I'm talking with Micah Godbolt. Micah is a front-end architect, trainer, and speaker based out of Portland, Oregon. Micah has a book that has been recently published by O'Reilly Media called Front-End Architecture for Design Systems. In the book, Micah delves into modern workflow for front-end developers. That includes talking about technologies like task runners, visual regression, schema-driven design, and much more. In this show, we talk about front-end architecture and the different paths in front-end architecture that people take to build modern sites. Some notes as to where I'll be hosting the AccessU Summit. AccessU Summit is a one-day, one-track virtual conference about advanced web and mobile accessibility. Learn new accessibility knowledge without leaving the office. Individual and meeting room tickets are available, but register now to grab early bird tickets at accessusummit.com. CSS DevConf is a two-day conference taking place in San Antonio, Texas, that tackles CSS and much, much more. Register now to pick up early bird tickets to the conference, and maybe pick up a post-conference workshop with Jonathan Snook, Rachel Neighbors on animation, or WispBoss on React.js. Learn more and buy your tickets at cssdevconf.com. Remember, you can always set it and forget it with a Non-Breaking Space show newsletter. When the show is ready, you're going to have the show links show up directly into your email box by signing up at newsletter.nonbreakingspace.tv. As always, you can find show notes and links discussed on the show at nonbreakingspace.tv. And be sure to follow me on Twitter at Telejct, that's T-E-L-E-J-E-C-T. And thank you for subscribing, liking, and telling others about the Non-Breaking Space show on iTunes. Now, on with the show. Cool, how are you doing?
Good. You know, it was funny when you when you emailed yesterday, I was like, was I just on your podcast? And then I looked back, like February of last year.
Wow.
But like that was a long time ago.
It's been quite a year. Yeah. So and things never change on the web. So we probably should even talk right now. Actually, we just like just replay the episode in February of last year.
Completely.
Yeah.
No, it's funny because I thought like I realize now that we must have talked like right when I was even I think I announced the book that I was writing the book on your show. Mm-hmm. I was thinking that like I'd released it and I was like, was that just what? No, that was a long time ago. So happy to come back on.
No problem. Yeah.
Exciting to see you're kind of back in the swing of it. And I need to get back to listening to more podcasts apparently.
Yeah. Well, the rage, you know, I just need to, track murder case, you know, that doesn't resolve anything whatsoever. And then you're very popular with podcasts.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah, that's how it goes. Yeah, so anyway, so you wrote the book. You were here last time in February. The previous February. And you were going to write the book. We were talking about the great presentation that you gave at CSS DevConf, what I called Front End Architecture. Yep. And now you have the book out. I'm showing it to people who are watching the YouTube channel. But the Front End Architecture for Design Systems. And last time we talked to you, we did not have the full title of the book, but
It's been an interesting twist when O'Reilly came back to me and said that they'd like to change the title a little bit. I was a little taken back. I was like, but it's front end architecture, like that's what the book is totally about. And really, their main concern was that front end architecture just wasn't explicit enough about exactly what it was, and there might people might buy it thinking it's something completely different. Right. And so they thought. Actually, went around and around on a few different title options, and I finally came to this because I had design systems in like the subtitle area. The modern blueprint for scalable and sustainable design systems is actually what I had down there. Okay. But moving it up to the title, honestly, I think it's been. I think it was a good choice. Like, I think I'm happy with it. And partially in the fact that I think design systems have kind of taken on a life of their own. I was actually just thinking about this today. I was like, I probably could have called it design system architecture.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think front-end architecture and building design systems can be very synonymous. There's a great Medium post recently. Kalig? Is that the Twitter handle? I'll go back and look. But about design system ops.
Oh. So
basically, the notion of a developer whose role was to facilitate the building and scaffolding and structure of the design system.
Wow.
And reading it over, I was like, oh, that's practically front-end architect as well. So yeah. I think there's I know we're all coming to the same kind of conclusion, the same kind of idea, and just slightly different titles and slightly different directions. Total random squirrel.
And that's one thing that we have with our industry. I don't want to ramble on too much, but it's just like the fact that we have all these, we have the same concepts, but the different names, and coming to conclusion on what we should call it is just very hard to determine. And then, in fact, I was reading this chat room was just someone was interested in becoming more of a front-end developer, and they were looking for help on resume building enhancements. And they were like, and part of the lessons that they was taught was like, yeah, just be very honest with your job, you know, with the skill sets that you have, because, you know, when you could say you're a webmaster, that's a very general term, but like you say webmaster, that means a lot of things. And so be very specific with that. So it's just, I find that our industry is very tough to wade through a lot of the I'm not going to say BS, but just a lot of the vagueness of mm-hmm. our vernacular, if you will. So
we certainly have a lot of that.
Yeah. Vagueness or vernacular. Kids, write that down and use it.
Jargon and lingo and...
yes. But what are your thoughts? I mean, for people who want to write a book, just before we dive into some of the specifics in the paper, but...
run away.
That's the honest approach. That's the honest answer I was looking for. But I was wondering what you... we thought of it because, you know, you gave it the presentation. I loved it so much. I wanted to talk to you more about it. You said you're going to write a book about it. And I was like, how was it writing a book? You know, like, would you do it again? What would you learn? What was the positives? What was the negatives?
Well, I think I just to go back and plug the book yet one more time.
Yeah.
I had a very tender moment when I finished this book. It was seriously like 9 months of work to do this, and to get to this ending point where like it's done. And of course, it wasn't even close to done because there's edits and I ended up writing another chapter and so on and so forth. But getting to the last chapter and writing the last chapter, and the last line was, and no matter what you do, never under any circumstance be afraid to write it all down in a book. And I think that still holds true, that regardless of what you're doing, what you're learning, what you're building, what you're pioneering, what you're championing, never be afraid to write it down in a book, because there's so much value in getting those thoughts onto paper. There's so much value in going through that process of what does it take to get these things that I'm thinking into this physical form, this final like thesis kind of thing. And for me with front-end architecture, like for the longest time, I kept on thinking I need to build something. I need to get all these ideas into one place, one kind of defining place, whether that was a blog article or a GitHub repo or something. My choice was ended up being going for a book and getting it all down into there. And it was a great experience because you end up learning probably like when you go into writing a book, you feel you have this base of knowledge that you want to get into the book. And as you write the book, that base of knowledge doubles by the time you actually get everything into the book. Because you end up spending so much time thinking everything through and having to come up with examples and having to find ways to be able to explain these difficult concepts in a way that any reader can understand. So, in general, write. I mean, whatever you're doing, whether it's a small blog article, a long medium think piece, or you know, a full book, get those ideas into written form. It's a huge benefit for every developer, regardless of what you're doing.
Right. I mean, I definitely agree with that, just because I feel like once you write it down, you figure out how to convince others about, you know, not the fact that they need to read what you wrote, but just the fact that you thought through the process of how to explain it. And it's like, there's a quote, like, I don't know, I'm not sure what I'm thinking until I write it down. So I've always had great ideas. So, you know, one of the things you write in the book is about design systems. And I just want to get your thoughts on where you were, like, you know, right now with, after I had written the book, with the design systems, and what your thoughts on that.
I think design systems are, so there's been a shift over the last several years. It's especially been evident in the Drupal community. I think it's just evident in front end community in general that the front end is, and this is what my book is fighting for, and front end architecture is fighting for, front end is becoming a first class citizen. That the front end of a website really needs to be thought out. It needs to have architecture behind it. It needs to have resources behind it, and planning, and time, and the opportunity to build things early. It needs to be an important thing in your project. And the shift has been happening in that people are starting to finally realize this and starting to put more weight into the front end. And because of that, we're needing to figure out what does this mean? Like, if we give resources to the front end team and front end development, what is the outcome of that effort? And I think the outcome of that effort is a design system, is not just better written front end, but a front end that is thought out from beginning to end, thought out in a way that it's flexible, that it's powerful, that it's modular, that it's smart, that it's, you know, backwards compatible and forward reaching, and thoroughly thought out piece of software, as opposed to, hey, here's a bunch of markup we're going to throw at you, try and make it look good. So we've finally been able to move to a place where we're dictating that markup. We're dictating the components and the styles and how the pieces fit together. And we're finally at a place where we're given the time and resources, and we have the tools and the knowledge to be able to actually build those things out and create those design systems. So, yeah, I think design systems are kind of that, it's the final form of this evolution with front end. And we need to be thinking, and everything that we build is a system for applying design to the content, that the CMS or the, you know, whatever's providing that information.
And so it seems like we're, you know, design systems are like what David would call mini
bootstraps.
Mini bootstraps, right? So
baby bootstraps.
Yeah, baby bootstraps.
I like baby bootstraps. Let's go with that one.
Baby bootstraps.
baby booty straps.
Okay. I'll write that one down. and what I liked about your book is that you also have I think it's an example at the end where you talk about, and you go through step by step, through the process of actually building out the system for, you know, a design system pretty much. So it's just, I thought that was great that you actually walked through the steps. And was that intentional? Or was that kind of like added on towards the end, or what?
Was it the Red Hat chapter the multiple steps? It was a look back as to how in the world did we get here? Mm-hmm. Because we started this project, it's been a year and change that we've been working on this rebuild, recreating the design system, and then design system really taking on even a more important role as it kind of developed. And I wanted to try and figure out, like, what was the path from the initial markup that we wrote? Like, we kind of wrote the initial markup of the system probably like back when I was starting to write the book, like back in February or something like that. And even though markup hasn't changed dramatically, the system around it and the organization around it and the tools around it and the philosophies around that has changed dramatically over the last year. Still the same like kind of small design system that we built, but the things that we built on top of it, moving towards more of a component API system, where that markup is now encapsulated into templates, and those templates are now interfacing with our CMS, not in a, hey, here's a template, throw it over the wall, try and make it work. It's a, here's the system, here's this component. This component has an API, it has an interface to it that requires a particular set of data to be able to return the proper markup. And so our CMS doesn't even see markup. And this was the kind of baffling thing for me for the longest time, was we created the system, we created these templates, we created what we thought was, you know, all you need to do is just, you know, developers just send them the right data over and you'll get the right markup back. And the developer response was always like, well, we need to see the markup. And like, where is the markup? I need to see the markup. And it's like, no, you shouldn't have to worry about the markup. And it was a very difficult transition to get to a point where we had the confidence from the developers to basically accept that their responsibility isn't the markup anymore. That their responsibility is just to supply the proper data to those templates to be able to render that out. And that confidence came from a proper schema. And because we initially said like, hey, here's the five values to pass into this template to return everything properly. And, you know, the response is, well, we need to see and make sure that it renders. Like, we want to see the other side, like, what's the markup supposed to look like? And they wanted to spend time like, you know, comparing markup and making sure things worked and all that. And we wanted to get past that. We wanted to say, like, here's our system, here's the API, send the data in, we'll be responsible for what comes out of it. And it took us getting to a point where we had a schema, an actual, like, a valid schema using JSON to basically specify, this is the data, this is the agreement between the template and the CMS. If the CMS passes this information to the template, we guarantee the markup that comes back is going to be the correct markup. And once we got to that point where we had those schemas, where we were able to test those schemas and test the output with visual regression to be able to test those APIs and make sure they work properly, we were finally able to get to that point where the developers were only concerned now was, okay, how do I get the data that the system needs? And past that, we're going to give the rest of the control back over to the front-end developers to take the system that they're creating and produce the markup that they want to create from that from that data. And that was that kind of that big shift. And that was kind of that evolution. That's where this whole thing started, was it started as markup that, like, okay, developers, here's the markup, go develop something. To, okay, here's the templates, you know, go render these templates. To, here's an API, like, here is the agreement of what data you need to provide to this template. Or complex set of templates to actually render this markup back to the system. And that transition went through tons of phases. And part of me is like, why did it take us so long to get to this final point? But the reason was because we were basically inventing new things and reinventing. And the places we're going hadn't really been pioneered yet. I'm sure someone's done it. Actually, I just ran into a Lonely Planet video that was 2014. And watching it now, actually, I watched it a couple years ago. I watched it like a year ago or so. Didn't quite click. I was like, okay, this is interesting, but I'm not quite getting it. I watch it now. I'm like, oh, yeah, all right, yeah. Now I completely understand where it is. I was talking about the Rizzo style guide system, and they were doing an API based design system or API based components. And now looking back at that, I wish I'd paid more attention to it or revisited the video more often, because they really nailed it. Ian Feather was the guy that did the video, and that we basically got to the same conclusion they got to. But it was a great experience getting there. We learned a lot through that, kind of having those challenges.
So I'm going to ask you probably a basic question and just let you know. So if I'm a developer in charge of the API and I need to construct a layout, or like, how does the layout get constructed then if I have to make API calls or something like that?
The way that we've been building things at Red Hat, and this is kind of one of the things that differs between what we're doing and the design system for Lonely Planet. With theirs, they mostly just have component APIs. So individual components have APIs. It's just kind of like there's Ruby-based system. So it's just a little function call that you pass data into. And I believe those just kind of go inline into their views. So as they build out their applications and they have a view, which basically kind of looks like a template, they have options to put a little function call, pass the data into it that's available in that view, and it renders and gets pulled back. So when they build a page out, and this is conjecture, so hopefully I'm not getting it wrong. When they build a page out, they build out their layouts, and they might build out some other application stuff around it. But when they want to use that card or that carousel or the modal or whatever the case is, instead of having to go copy the markup from somewhere, they're able to just to put in a small Ruby function call of some sort, pass the data into it, and the markup gets rendered and returned back to their template. The difference, what we're doing at Red Hat is everything's band based. So everything's kind of like content stacked on content, stacked on content and down the road. So we realized that we could take a look at each of those bands and figure out, instead of having to have people piecemeal things together and build out those things manually, we could really identify most of those bands. We have a band that's called a logo wall, and it's really just a bunch of logos with links and like a title and a footer. There's no need for somebody to build that out. That entire band can be encapsulated inside of the API. So we've basically abstracted out a majority of these patterns into a bit of a larger API that might take a dozen or so different pieces to build out each of those bands. So really, it's just a matter of stacking an API call on top of an API call on top of an API call inside of the body of the website. And we're doing this with a module inside of Drupal, but in any other instance, you could do it in any other way that you want. But again, the design is band-based, so it's pretty much just stacking things on top of each other from one design onto the next, onto the next. And so we're not as worried with having to fit things into a layout in the way that we're building things. It's more of a content content-based site versus like a some kind of application or something like that.
I'll go totally throw out my ignorance out here, but so it would be like a headless CMS pretty much. Is that what's going on? So like you through API calls to get the markup once you have like the content. Like, oh, content needs to go here. Let me go get the API and figure out what needs to go here.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically it. I mean, we, especially in Drupal, the whole notion of headless was super exciting just a couple of years ago. With Angular coming into the scene and having a really strong, robust JavaScript framework to be able to turn data into markup, a lot of people got really excited about what Drupal could be like if Drupal was just a content repository. It was just a place to store content and push that content up to the front-end layer to be rendered out into markup. And it's that separation. It's a separation of concerns between a back-end system providing markup, back-end system providing data, and the front-end system taking that data and doing whatever in the world they want with it. Turn it into whatever markup, whatever display, whatever UI that they want to build on that front-end. A complete separation between the front end and the back end, where you could swap out a front end and just have a completely different look for your website. So super popular, but there are some challenges in moving the entire UI to the front end, authentication, forms, and various other issues that just made it difficult. Not to mention just rendering everything in the front end, performance wise, and the fact that if JavaScript wasn't working, you wouldn't have a website. Those types of things. So the approach that we've taken, and similar to Lonely Planet approach, is that it's all server side. And the advantage here is that it doesn't take turning the CMS on its head to be able to do this approach. The CMS is still, taking markup and sending it out to the user. There's the entire caching system that you'd use is the exact same caching system. I mean, you can render the page and cache that page exactly as you normally would. The difference here is that instead of going through, Drupal's got a very large, very complex rendering system that they're trying to figure out what they can do with it to make better right now. But what we've decided to do is basically make to pull the theming engine, the rendering engine off of Drupal and use a completely separate rendering engine for that. Still PHP based. We're using Twig, which is actually what the new Drupal 8 is running on. So we like the synergy there. So we've got a completely separate library actually doing all the rendering, which means everything's still server side. When Drupal wants to render one of these bands, instead of just using their internal rendering engine, they just make a function call to the PHP library and it returns markup. And then Drupal goes, "Hey, great. I've got the markup. I know what to do now." So we still get that separation. We still get Drupal saying, "I don't care about the markup. I'm just here to get data. Make sure the data is correct. I've got a schema that defines what the data is supposed to be. And then I'm going to hit that API. I'm going to get markup back. And then I know what to do now. I can cache it. I can put it through filters. I can, combine it with other markup that I've created, that the CMS has created, and those types of things." So it's a real powerful setup that gives us a lot of flexibility. And it doesn't require us to completely reinvent the horse or cart, or whatever that analogy is. Wheel. Reinvent the
horse,
wheel.
Cart, wheel. I just hate it when I reinvent a horse. Uh-huh. Awesome. Yeah. So you mentioned earlier about proper schemas and making sure, how hard it is. I imagine it'd be somewhat difficult to come up with a proper schema or for all your, your components. I guess it's...
Actually, schemas are easy enough. They almost write themselves. I've got a, for instance, I've got a Yeoman generator for our system where, if you're not familiar with Yeoman, it's a great tool for scaffolding out, entire projects. I need a React project. Yo, React project. And it builds out, this entire huge project full of files and whatnot. But Yeoman can also be used, just to create small instances of files. And in this case, we're using Yeoman to create individual components. So if I need a new component, I say, give me a new component. And it asks what kind of component. And then it also asks, what are the fields inside this component? And I say, it needs a title and it needs a headline and, it needs a content area and, an image or something like that. And I pass those in, it generates about 7 or 8 files that are required for each component. And inside those components, there is a JSON schema file, and it has all of our boilerplate stuff, as well as, here's the title, it's a string, here is the headline, it's a string, it scaffolds the entire thing out. It's not smart enough right now to say, what type of property is this? Is a string or an array or an object? No, I mean, right now it just puts the words in there, so it's easy to kind of go from there. But you could certainly build out something for creating schemas that was that interactive, where the Yeoman generator would just walk you through every single question. Is this required? Is it not required? If it's an array, what are the items in the array? Those types of things. So, I guess that aside, whether you do Yeoman or not, JSON schemas are pretty easy to write. I mean, especially when you start off with a simple one, just describing the template. But the great thing is they can get more and more complex and powerful, and the things you can do with them even get greater. You're able to in a schema specify not just single properties, but also arrays of properties and objects of properties, as well as being able to reference other schemas as well. So in a component-based system where you have a lot of components being able to reference other components. Like we have this card, which is really just kind of a layout container that can have backgrounds and paddings and those kind of things a normal card would have. Well, you can put stuff into a card. And so by doing that in the card schema, we can actually specify, these are the things that can go in a card. These are like the dozens of things that can go into this card. And we can actually reference those other schemas. So almost just like a templating language, you're able to say like, hey, you can put a CTA in here, and hey, you can put an image and a video and a quote, and all these other smaller pieces can go into this. So the schemas not only allow us to lay out the data required for a single template, but also talk about the relationships between templates. So we were kind of amazed that the more we got into JSON schemas and about how lucky we were to stumble upon it, to start using that, and the value that came from using the standard kind of accepted schema paradigm. Because the value we got from was huge. All of the third-party tools, the third-party validators, just the community in general is just been amazing, the value that's brought to the system. We keep on finding ourselves kind of just baffled as something just works flawlessly. Like the first time, we're like, wow, that was a really good choice to go with JSON schemas and to stick to the spec. I think that was one of the other things is we found places where, this just isn't working right. Well, what if we just, what if we just don't do it the JSON schema way and just do it differently, like just do our own kind of thing. And we realized how lucky we were not to do that, that we stuck to it and we continue to be able to leverage the value of that.
Can you dive that a little bit deeper? Like what type of things like did you run into? Like,
I'm trying to remember some of the instances. There are just some limitations. It's a growing spec. It's on version 4 right now. I know 5 is in the works. There's some things we couldn't do. Honestly, I don't think I have any really good examples. I wish I remember what they were. It was really early in the process.
Sorry.
we decided early on to not just use it as like, hey, here's an example of approach with JSON schemas, but like, no, let's use JSON schemas exactly as they're supposed to be used. Let's make sure that whatever we're writing is valid JSON schema. JSON schema it's nice because it is flexible enough that you can kind of define your own schema. You can actually, the funny thing is the JSON schema specification actually has a JSON schema that it validates to. So the schema that you write is actually valid JSON to another JSON schema. It's really meta and really crazy. But it's flexible enough that it allows you to say, hey, I want a custom property. Like there's instances where we need to communicate something to Drupal. We need to say we're building something here that's unique, or we're building something that Drupal needs to know about. And we need to inform Drupal that, hey, this is like, for instance, this is an image, and an image has has a source field and alt field and whatnot. So pretty simple. But when it gets into Drupal, we don't want just a field for somebody to have to put a URL to an image into. We've got modules in Drupal that help us to find the images we want and use the image and provide alt text and those types of things. When this object comes in. Don't treat it as just a set of fields. Treat it as an image and use a proper widget inside of Drupal to be able to provide the text to that. So we were able to go in and say, okay, let's call this entity image. And it was just an additional property or additional value they're able to add to the schema that was completely valid JSON. It doesn't mean anything to anyone else unless they implement it, but it's valid JSON. It's not going to trip any of the JSON validators. We're able to take that information and pass it on in. So we fought against making JSON schemas specifically for the CMS, like to pull the Drupalisms out of Drupal and put them into our schemas. Instead, we made everything schema-y, JSON-y, and let Drupal be able to figure out what that meant instead of going the other way around. So we kept a system that could be used in Drupal. You could take those exact same schemas and pull those into WordPress and hey, whatever WordPress uses for images, now they can implement and say, oh, okay, whenever I see that entity is image, use this widget for choosing an image instead of just a field for that. So it's been a really valuable to stick to that and be able to have something that in the end of the process is still 100% valid JSON schema.
Cool. Awesome. I mean, yeah, it sounds like just the benefits of going that way are just outrageously high. So I'll just stick with that. So, and your book, I just want to go back to your book, you know, because it's what we're having here. But I mean, your book goes beyond, you know, design systems. But I mean, you have a thing about setting up task runners, workflow. I mean, just anything, you know, any thoughts about the book in general? Like you felt like awesome in terms of you wish you knew about beforehand.
Everything. I wish I knew all.
Well, that way make it more easier. But I mean, there's sometimes I write a book and I just like, and it's I like writing books because it allows me to explore new things and allows me to learn new things. And so, and a lot of times I find like, wow, I didn't know that before, and I have the, I guess not the pleasure, but I guess the honor of like writing more about it and helping people learn.
Certainly. Like for instance, I've read a chapter on Pattern Lab specifically because I want to talk about some of the documentation tools that we use when creating design systems. And to be honest, like I'd spent time looking at Pattern Lab and kind of poking around at it a couple times, but I've been doing this project for so long that I haven't had a chance to do a project with a full-on Pattern Lab instance in it. So I had to be honest, I was like, I don't know how this exactly works. and especially I didn't know how how it worked differently from what we had been building. And I think that was kind of a lot of it was we had a slightly different approach, more of an API based approach, or data driven approach. And I always felt that Pattern Lab was a little different because it was a little bit more of a template driven approach. And I was trying to figure out what that meant and how those things were different. Also the commonalities, there's actually a lot of commonalities between the two. Like they both take a set of JSON data and pass it into templates, which then call other templates. So there's a lot of similarities between the two systems, but it was really interesting to dive in and see like how can I distinguish the Pattern Lab versus the systems that we're building. And I'm needing to get my brain around this because I'm going to be talking about it next month. And the main difference between a template-driven system and a data-driven system is with Pattern Lab, it's always template first. You write the templates. One template includes another template, which includes another template, which includes that atom way down at the end. And then the data is basically something you write at the end to basically to plug in those holes, to plug in, you know, wherever you see a field that needs some content, user content, you write data to be able to plug into there. So it's really you build out a bunch of templates and go, okay, what data do I need? All right, I'm gonna do all this data. Okay, here's some data to pass in. And now I can change the data to make it be something different. So it's not really a data first or an API first situation. It's really a bunch of templates that are kind of being combined together to build something. Actually, I had a great talk with both Brad Frost and Dave Olson recently about kind of some of the differences of Pattern Lab and the approach that we've been taking. I just want to give a chance to demo the schema-based approach and kind of curious, like, would Pattern Lab ever go that direction? Is that something that they're interested in doing? And one of the really interesting things that came out of it was the notion that Pattern Lab was never designed to be something that emulated production. Pattern Lab was a way to be able to prototype and build out pages in an atomic way, which is to say, you know, small pieces combined with other pieces combined with larger pieces to build full pages. And the approach that we've always taken is we wanted a design system first, a design system that emulated production, and we kind of started building a Pattern Lab on top of that. So it's been kind of this interesting process of us turning our design system and building our own Pattern Lab on top of it, and then watching Pattern Lab trying to get closer and closer to being a production-ready tool. Seeing if there's a convergence between the two. And I think they'll continue to be separate tools. I mean, the goal of Pattern Lab has always been to be able to scaffold out pages, to be able to build things really fast, a prototype, to make things easily. And that's to say there's a lot of conventions in Pattern Lab that take a lot of the work out of it. to be able to say, I just want, you know, add in this thing and things are automatically built out for you. And that's always been the goal of it, is to make it easy to build things out, to take away convention over configuration, I believe is, yes, I believe that's the way that they said it. Whereas an API approach is lots of configuration and not many conventions. So if you want something to be associated or connected together, it's something that you have to explicitly write out. And that's, you know, that's what you need for a system that's going to be a production system. You need to be able to expect, you know, when I do this, this is going to happen. So getting back to the original point, writing about some of these topics, needing to have a chapter in there explaining how this thing worked and diving through, you know, kind of the mechanics of it was a great challenge, because it gave me the opportunity to say, like, I need to sit down and figure this thing out. I need to learn enough that I can explain it to everybody. You know, I might have an inkling, a feeling of my own, but until I get in there and write an entire chapter on this thing, chapter that I'm willing to publish and have people read, you know, I need to get in there and figure it out.
Right. Yeah. Well, it seems like it's kind of two different approaches. Like, I'd see like a designer focused, you know, individual and front end would gravitate towards Pattern Lab because they can visually see it and they need to get buy-in from their clients about, you know, responsible design and the layouts that they need to tackle. Where I feel like, you know, maybe with your background and the problem that you're trying to tackle, you're there day to day in trying to develop it from that point up. So it just feels like you're both getting there, but just in, you know, different directions. So
that's, yeah, one of the things we had the benefit of is our design was already done. So we already had, like, the site had already launched and we had tons of content already out there. So it was, you know, it wasn't a matter of trying to build something that someone would sign off on. They've already signed off, you know, the site's launched. We were just trying to figure out, is there a better way to build these bands out? Is there a better way to take this visual language that the designers had created and turn that into a system for being able to, you know, create more things inside of that visual language. So we didn't have to worry about getting that buy-in. We just had to figure out, you know, how can we best create something that's going to allow us to make new things, to be able to, like, take that same design language but speak it in a different way or create new content from it. And that's actually the hopefully a decent segue, unless you had something else in mind, of talking about design languages and the role that they play inside of a design system. Because a design system is very much code. I mean, it's very much a you know, we're trying to, you know, codify how to use a visual language that ourselves or someone else has created. So, I mean, a design system really doesn't make decisions on, like, colors and typography and those types of things. Like, that's all typically been established inside of a visual language. So this next month, I'm going to be speaking at DrupalCon out in New Orleans about design systems. And I've been spending the last couple of weeks going through building my outline out of what I want to talk about. And I know I wanted to at least approach the topic of design systems of visual language. And so I started a couple bullet points of that, and then below it had some bullet points of design systems. And then over the last week or so, the section on visual language has started to grow into where I hope I can get this to 50-50, where I need to get more design system stuff into it. Because I think there's a lot of power in understanding. It's helpful in building design systems to understand what you're trying to accomplish. And what we are trying to accomplish with a design system is a design system is the study of a visual language. So really the end goal of a design system is to see a visual language or to take a visual language and to study it, to break it down into its smallest pieces, to break it down into the core essence of what that visual language is, which is a combination of fonts and line heights and font sizes and colors and even paddings and margins and spacing and rhythm. and how those all those pieces interact and play together. And then also how those pieces are combined to make larger pieces, to make kind of words, to make kind of ideas. Like, how do you put those paddings and colors and fonts and margins into making a form element? Like, how does that form together to make that more complex thing? And then past that, how is that language, what's the syntax of that language? How do things get put together into larger organisms or templates or whatever you want to call them? How do you make a hero section of a page using that visual language? And as we break that visual language down into those pieces and those steps, we can then start putting a system to that. And the research I've been doing over the last couple of weeks is kind of led me to realize that the same study that we put towards verbal languages or written languages is very akin to what we need to do with visual languages. So the linguistic study of a verbal language is very eerily similar to the study of a visual language, which results in a design system. So it's this really kind of, it's a really fun combination, getting to look at how do we tear design systems, how do we tear visual languages down, how do we understand them better, and then how can we make a system that allows us to communicate what the visual language is trying to say. So like with the English language, we've got all these words. We've got, tons of nouns and adjectives and adverbs and all of these words that have meaning. But we can speak them, like, we know how to verbally make the sounds to make the words. But understanding how words get put together and the syntaxes and the grammar of it and the structure and the fact that you need a noun and a verb to make a sentence. And what is a sentence structure? All the study that you can put into a spoken language or a verbal language is really akin to what we're trying to do with a design system of how do things get put together? What are the rules? What are the assets? What's the syntax of this language and how can we speak things? Because the point of a verbal language is to communicate. We're doing that right now. We're using these words to try and convey ideas from one person to another, or hopefully lots of people. And so with a visual language, we're trying to do the same thing. We're trying to convey ideas. We're trying to convey, hey, you can trust me because look at this website. This website conveys trust, or this website conveys fun, or this website conveys confidence, or whatever that is that you're trying to convey with that visual language, that's communication. And there's also communication of, hey, click here, or go to this, and then go here and fill out this form. Like, there's a path that you're trying to lead people down, or, here is a display of our products and here's the range of things that you can purchase. Like, look at this one first, the whole, cost benefit display. I've lost what that's called. That's the whole point of that, where you've got your cheap one, your medium one, your expensive one, your crazy expensive one, but hey, medium one's the best value. Like, that's communicating to the user information, and that's doing it through a visual language. So the point of a design system is to recognize that the verbal language that you have, the design language that you have is there to speak things. It wants to communicate to the users. The design system is there to try and figure out, okay, what do we need to communicate and how can we communicate it? And let's create a system that allows us to communicate anything we need to say. So if we need to be able to put this sentence together to express an idea or a thought, let's make sure we have a system to do that. And really the point of the design system is to make sure that anything that the visual language wants to communicate, we have a way to communicate it. And as you build up those ways to communicate, you eventually build up a system that is able to speak anything that visual language wants to say. And it's a really neat relationship between those two things. And it's been fun to explore it. And even now, trying to speak it, I'm kind of exploring it. there's a lot of fun there. So I'm looking forward to this talk. Hopefully I'll have a chance to go through it several more times in my head and have a good set of slides that makes us all make sense.
Okay, that's good. Well, I do want to, like, I mentioned that Scott McCloud's book, Understanding Comics, because, like, you talk about the difference between studying words and I guess, design. There's actually, Scott McCloud has he's a comic book creator, great speaker, if you ever get a chance to see him, Scott McCloud. I think he's actually Scott McCloud on Twitter, too. But he's got this phenomenal book, he's written in 1993, I think, called Understanding Comics. And back in the day, I probably mentioned this a million times in my podcast and past episodes, but because I love the book, is that I think on he's got this great graphic at the beginning of the book where he talks about words and the reality. So like you move from, he talks about like we have words to describe objects, but then we have words, but words themselves are actually object or like are actually visual elements put together to form, you know, meaning, abstract meaning. And then so you go to like the left, he has a nice pyramid graphic where he goes from words to like a simple icon of a face to like cartoon faces that you see in a comic strip to more stylized that you would see in a comic book pretty much. And then you go further and further down to like photorealistic. And so it's a really nice breakdown, almost like an atomic structure level in terms of you have the atomic level of just these abstract markings, which, you know, like letter A was actually like, I believe it's like a, used to be the marking for an ox before it became a letter A. And then, and so our rich, you know, language is based off of icons and imagery. So it's pretty nice. I really look forward to the talk and some of that too. So let's see what you come up with that. So I'm really, really enthused about that concept. So.
Yeah. It's kind of me, like regardless of the language that you look at, whether it's verbal, whether it's sign language, whether it's like a computer language, you know, all language can be broken down into smaller pieces, visual language. Studying each of those there's a lot of depth. There's a lot of opportunities to get in there and learn a lot more about what you're doing by learning how the things break down. And I think the amazing thing is that, you know, Brad Frost came along and pioneered, championed is a better word, the idea of atomic design. You know, and the thing is, like, you know, there's really nothing new under the sun. You know, it was by no means a revolutionary thing. It's the realization that that visual language is a language, and like any language, can be broken down. And you know, we've been breaking languages down and studying them for quite a long time. So just recognizing that this is yet another language and it can be broken down into smaller pieces as well. And by studying it more comprehensively, we're able to understand it better and then make better systems and make better, you know, explanations and rules and syntax around those languages. So study, make better things, make awesome design systems.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. So you're working on that. Anything? That's a good starting point, but for the show, is there anything else you're passionate about right now, or you're trying to? It just sounds like you're not. It sounds like you're like busy trying to get the presentation wrapped.
Yeah, mostly that. I mean, really, everything in this book. I mean, the great thing about writing this book is I got to break everything up into four different sections. There's four pillars. So it's kind of fun because I get a chance to kind of dive into each of the pillars and like the last. Last talk I gave at the RWD Summit. That's what it was called, right? It's a couple weeks ago. Was all about testing. So diving back into my testing chapter and flexing some of those muscles again. Going back into processes and getting back into Grunt and Gulp. And it's kind of great. These pillars of just unending things to learn about and explore and to try out new things. So if you get a chance to read the book, I'd love to hear feedback. I'd love to hear how people are able to get inspired by this. Writing a book is one of the difficult things about it is it's out there and people now read it and will respond on it. The first two reviews that I got for this book were like super negative. And I tell you that hurts, but you know, it is what it is. And the reason that the reviews came back negative is I think they were expecting a very technical book. Like, here's how you do X, Y, Z. Like, here's the steps for this. Here's the steps for that. Like, when you finish this book, you'll be able to go and build anything.
Right.
And, you know, the book is not that. Like, the book is partly my journey over the last year, the year or two at Red Hat.
Right.
And this thing that we've built. It's also a call to arms. It's a get people excited about these things. Get people excited about front end, about design systems, about, you know, making our front end code matter, and exploring what are the different ways that you can add value and add quality to the front end code. And you know, that's a takeaway message. Not, hey, I learned how to do, you know, a whole bunch of stuff from this book. It's like, no, be inspired. Be more understanding of the tools that are out there and then the next steps that you want to take. Like, maybe you're super interested in processes and you want to, you know, figure out your workflow for your team. Maybe you want to figure out testing. Maybe you want to figure out, you know, better code structure and code quality tools. You know, those are the things I want to inspire. And hopefully the book will give you some ideas as to how we did it, you know, to get you moving, as well as other tools and just explanations and ways that you can sell that to the rest of your team.
Yeah, I mean, there's a section called "Who This Book Is For" right here, right?
Yeah.
So you write that, and then people buy the book. They just don't read that part at all, and so they go through the book. They go, "This book is not for me." And
yeah, you're right. It's not for you.
Yeah, you could avoid the whole scenario if you just read this part right here. Yeah, I wrote the negative reviews, man. Like, from people who just, I got a negative review for the CSIS cookbook, which is this behemoth book. It's like 800 pages long. And the negative feedback was, one of them was, this is before we had like SMACs or, you know, or object-oriented CSS or whatnot. So one of the reviews like that stings back, I'm trying to like get some sympathy for it from you, Michael, now that you've written the book, is that...
no, plenty, don't worry.
Like, I wrote a chapter about, you really need to write semantic HTML in order to associate the CSS to your HTML. So here are some tips, some general HTML tips. This is chapter one of how to write good HTML, right? That was just, you know, just basic stuff, right? And now, in today's parlance, if you will, it'd be like, this is the CSS you write in the content portion of your CMS. Like, this is stuff that you don't get mixed up, right? So this, you keep it separate, which is what, you know, Chris Coyer wrote recently. But I had someone like, why is there an HTML in my CSS book?
one star.
I go like, oh, what? Like, you know, CSS doesn't operate in the vacuum. You know that?
Yeah, right? Exactly. Like, you're writing selectors that are supposed to attach to markup. It's crazy.
Oh man, that felt so good, man. I've been holding that back for like 6 years, Mike. Just to be able to tell you that story, you know, that means something. Cool. Yeah. The book is Front End Architecture for Design Systems: A Modern Blueprint for Scalable and Sustainable Websites, published by O'Reilly. And if you want to know, it is, the animal on the front is a pink-headed warbler. So definitely.
I was pretty happy when people were like, you know, so what animal are you getting? I was like, well, I'm from the Portland area, so of course they put a bird on it. And that's,
yeah, there you go. Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, so definitely look for the pink bird book. Right,
and there's the eyeball on the spine of it. I got a kick out of that.
Oh yeah, it's watching you. Yeah, so
yeah, I've got like a dozen of them back of my shelf. And so there's this like row of eyeballs behind me.
It's like the Pink Floyd album where they put the LED light in the CD back when we had CDs. You know, just put like blink. You know, all right, man, I'm old. Okay, so hey, cool, awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here again, and congratulations on the book. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you.
And I hope to talk to you soon.
All right.
Oh, well, thanks a lot. But how can people find you on the internet?
Oh, they can probably do that. Yeah. You can definitely catch me on Twitter. It's just Micah Godbolt, kind of as it sounds, MICAHGODBOLT. That's probably the best place to find me. And from there, you can link off to my profile with all the other crazy stuff I do. Also write at Micah.codes. I need to do more writing there. I've been too focused on trying to get some talks done. But definitely check that out. Also, I do a podcast called SaaS Bytes. Check that out at SaaS Bytes on Twitter. I'm going to put my foot down. I'm going to be relaunching probably after this next talk with a bit of a rebranding. But if you follow on that Twitter account, I'm just going to change that Twitter account with a new rebranding, and you'll still be able to follow me.
But so, that's on YouTube as well, right?
Yeah, it's on YouTube. I need to figure out what to do with that, because I've got YouTube/SaaSBytes, and I can't change that. You can't change the URL of it. So do I abandon that account and the subscribers, or do I just stick with an old URL? Naming things is hard.
Yeah, it is. But yeah, I would, I don't know, man. I just stick with YouTube. I think YouTube is really the future. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good place for it, for sure.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Anyway, cool. Well, thank you so much for having us, for being here, sorry. And oh, let me try that one more time. Thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I'll see you soon on the show.